are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Thirteen new insomnia-inducing murder stories from the true crime master Michael Benson, including Monster of the Low Country, Born to Raise Hell, The Hollywood Ripper, The Murder of Craig Rideout, Call Me Daddy, Savage Waitress, King Creep, A Dark Stretch of Road, Family of Terror, The Telltale Knot, Vengeance is Mine, Breckenridge, and a few thoughts on the Black Dahlia. Dozens of photos. An excerpt from the book's final story. It is the most famous American murder case not involving a celebrity. A crime so horrible that it changed the tone of an entire city. Before, throughout Los Angeles, women routinely walked home alone after they required escorts. And all because of the mind-bogglingly bizarre ordeal of Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia. A celebrity only in death. The 22-year-old raven-haired beauty, a showbiz wannabe, was found on the morning of January 15, 1947. She was naked, severed into two pieces below the ribcage, and arranged on the ground like a piece of surreal art. Arms above her head, legs spread, her upper body parallel but to the side of her lower body, a sardonic smile carved into her face with a knife, and portions of a breast and a thigh cut out. The missing piece of a thigh flesh was found inserted in her rectum. The skin attached to that piece contained a rose tattoo. She'd been tortured for days, tortured till dead, drained of blood and dumped, no, presented at the edge of a vacant lot, left foot only inches from the sidewalk, hair freshly washed in the Alemet Park section of LA. The cause of death was drowning. She drowned on her own blood. The book that we're featuring this evening is Dark Roses, 13 Horrific True Stories, with my special guest, journalist and author, Michael Benson. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Michael Benson.
Hey, thanks for having me, Dan.
Thank you. It's always a treat to have you on, and congratulations on this latest. It certainly lives up to the name, 13 Horrific True Stories. Let's just start, because I gave a basic synopsis. In the synopsis, I gave a sort of the contents of this incredible book. Let's just get you talking about some of the first characters, some of the first killers and subjects of this book, Monster of the Low Country. Tell us about Stephen Stanko and a little bit about this story.
Okay. I have written about psycho killers of all shapes and sizes, both major genders, but none were more sinister than Stephen Stanko, the Monster of the Low Country. He was different from other psychos. He had charisma. He was a social being, or he could perfectly imitate one. And he metamorphosed into a Pied Piper party animal while under torturous stress. He reminded people of Ted Bundy. He had superior social skills, very rare for a cold-blooded killer. As a rule, they have no real understanding of compassion, yet Stanko was observant, and he had emotional mimicry skills to rival an Oscar winner. He could make friends, pick up women, command the spotlight, even when he was completely desperate and on the run for his life. As a kid, he seemed to have everything going for him. His dad was demanding and impossible to please, but Stephen, by all accounts, had a lot going on. He entered high school tall and good-looking, good at sports, baseball, football, plus he was smart. His teachers got dreamy-eyed thinking about him. They knew that the boy was going to go far, and they were going to be able to say that they knew him when. Stanko had it all mapped out. He was going to join the Air Force Academy. He was going to become a fighter pilot, an astronaut, and then president of the United States. And he had the drive to do it. His father had seen to that, but then something went bad. When he was 15, his older brother died in a suspicious fire.
Right.
And Stephen thought, like in a battlefield promotion, he would move up a notch in his father's estimation, but it didn't work out that way. Dad seemed to hold Stephen responsible for his brother's death, and Stephen fell apart. Instead of schoolwork, he worked on schemes, convoluted plots, get-rich schemes, things like that. He took the SAT exam, didn't do that great, and was rejected by the Air Force Academy. So when high school was over, instead of becoming a fighter pilot, an astronaut, and president of the United States, he took a couple of courses at a community college, skipped class, and started stealing cars. He became a full-fledged con man, but he could tell lies for weeks without betraying himself. But when his lies were exposed and he was cornered by reality, he lashed out with violence, real Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde type. First time came in 1996 when he tried to kill his longtime girlfriend, Liz. The attack sent him to prison for 8 years. And like many psychopaths, Stanko functioned better in jail. Lack of freedom helped him focus, and he wrote a book about life in prison while he was in prison. He got it published while incarcerated, and he was released a better man than he went in. He came out a published author, and he immediately planned to write a second book, a sort of encyclopedia of serial killers, which, as it turned out, was more of a book about how to become a serial killer. Right. Yeah. To help with his research, he found a beautiful librarian named Laura Ling in the low country of South Carolina, a divorcee living in a tiny house with her teenage daughter. Now, free outside of prison, Stanko couldn't write a book. He could only con people out of money. And again, he lied until he painted himself into a corner. And this time, when Mr. Hyde came out, he came out big time. He raped his girlfriend's teenage daughter and then forced the girl to watch as he beat her mother to death. He then slit the girl's throat, calmly took a shower, and then left stealing the librarian's car. But what he didn't know was that the teenager had survived and had managed to call 911, reporting that her attacker was Stephen Stanko. Yeah. Police were on his trail in minutes. So Stanko drives to another friend's trailer home, an older man named Henry Lee Turner, tells Henry that his dad has just died and he needs someone to talk to. Turner says, sure, come on in. So while Turner's shaving, Stanko shoots him to death with his own gun. Then he leaves Laura Ling's car parked at Turner's trailer, takes Turner's pickup truck, and heads off. And he decides to hide out in the open. He drove to Augusta, Georgia, where the Masters tournament was underway, golf tournament. Tiger Woods in the lead, but it was a tournament plagued by rain, causing the bars of Augusta to be filled with people. So Stanko put on a golf shirt, a pair of cargo shorts, and it didn't matter how often they showed his photo on TV, he blended, at least for a while. Yeah, he bar hopped, conspicuously spent money, met a woman. He was invited home to sleep on her couch because he'd been drinking. He went to church with her and her parents the next morning. And then he went alone to a mall to get breakfast in a diner. And as he did this, the girl he'd met the previous night got a call from her mother saying that Steve, the guy in church, was wanted for murder, had his picture in the newspaper. So they called the police and Stanko was arrested coming out of the diner. So this is Stephen Christopher Stanko. He's one of the rare psychopaths who had the looks and charisma to start new relationships with both men and women and be socially active even as he was running for his life. But the question remains, did Stephen's brother's suspicious death really spoil a golden boy future? Or had Stephen been a con artist all along, with the cracks in his schemes only becoming visible following his brother's death?
Yes, absolutely. You have the next story, Born to Raise Hell, about Richard Speck. And many people are familiar with this story, with this one student nurse, Corazon Amureo, escaping this killer, Richard Speck, by him losing count and her hiding under a bed. You do include some very, very interesting, horrifying information that we talked about just before the program in this story about Richard Speck. Could you just tell us a little bit about the end of this story that, again, many people might not know of? And before we talk about a very, very horrifying story, the Hollywood Ripper.
Sure. Speck was a cover boy for TVs and newspapers and magazines in the summer of 1966. His crime was worse than anybody could previously have imagined. And he became part of the American nightmare. You know, Richard Speck was America's boogeyman for a while, but he managed to have a second act. He worked his way into our nightmares a second time. So in prison, he temporarily endeared himself to the prison population by rescuing an injured bird and then nursing it back to health. Just like in the Hollywood movie, The Birdman of Alcatraz. Mm-hmm. But when Speck was told that he had to get rid of the bird, instead of releasing it, he threw it into an electric fan, resulting in a storm of feathers and blood. And he told a guard that he couldn't have the bird. No one could have the bird.
Sure.
Speck died in 1991, his bad heart finally giving out on him. He was 49. But before that, he made himself known to us in a hideous manner. There was a videotape released that showed Speck in prison with female breasts, the result of illegal hormone injections he'd gotten in prison, giving oral sex to another inmate. sort of a sex tape, I guess you'd call celebrity sex tape in the worst possible way. And on the tape, someone asked Speck why he killed those nurses. And he said, it wasn't their night.
Yeah. Tell us about the Hollywood Ripper, little less known serial killer.
Yeah. Well, I think the interesting thing about the Hollywood Ripper is that it sort of ties into Ashton Kutcher's story, Rising to Stardom in Hollywood. Story starts 9 a.m. on a Saturday morning in 1993 when Rick Picaccio puts his dog on a leash and comes out to walk him. This is in Glenview, Illinois. And he finds his daughter, Trisha, dead on the front porch. She'd been murdered and left on the front porch of the house. They tried to figure out who did it. They couldn't find out. The case grew cold. And life in Glenview, Illinois went on a little sadder and scarier than before. You jump ahead 8 years, there's a vicious murder of 22-year-old student model Ashley Lauren Ellerin in the Hollywood Hills in a yellow wooden rented bungalow, which I visited. She was less than a year out of school, prettiest girl in her class. And like thousands of others, every year she went to Hollywood to find fame and fortune. And not for the first time in Hollywood, a beautiful young woman won her greatest fame and death. The murder scene was on Pinehurst Road, and it was discovered on Thursday morning, February 22nd, 2001. She'd been stabbed a phenomenal 47 times. Her throat had been cut so deeply that she was practically decapitated. And the case gained much publicity by the fact that the night before, Ashley had been scheduled to go on a date with actor Ashton Kutcher, who was an initial suspect.
Right.
He was a star at the time of that 70s show, and he made a couple movies too. And he told police he'd gone to pick her up the night before, but she didn't answer the door. He peeked in a window and thought he saw wine stains, but he knew he'd been at a party in that house a few weeks earlier and knew there had been drinking going on. So he didn't think it was blood. He was quickly exonerated. And again, the case grew cold.
Right.
Jump ahead another 4 years, December 1st, 2005, a woman named Maria Bruno is asleep in her house in El Monte, California. And she's a mother of four, recently separated from her husband. And as it turned out, she was in an apartment house that was supposed to have good security, did her no good at all. An intruder climbed in through her kitchen window and stabbed her to death in her bed. She probably never woke up. Left alone with his victim, the killer had fun and mutilated the body, cut open her breasts, pulled out her implants. The breasts were removed completely then, and one of her nipples was cut off and placed over her mouth.
Jeez.
Which leads us to Santa Monica, California, another crime scene. I've walked through it. And I walked through this one at night, just to get an idea of what the alleys of Santa Monica look like.
Wow.
But this is 26-year-old Michelle Murphy, and she was a fighter. She says she went to sleep at about 10:30, woke up about a half hour later with a man straddling her. And the next thing she knew, she was being stabbed in the chest, the shoulder, and the arm. She grabbed the knife. Her most severe cuts were on her hand as she defended herself. Eventually, she got a really good boot in, kicked him off the bed, and he retreated into the other room. And she started screaming, "Why are you doing this to me?" And he said, "I'm sorry," and left. He had cut himself during the attack, and he just lived on the other side of the alley. So when the police arrived, all they had to do was follow the blood drops to his house, and boom, they had him. And when they tested his DNA, they found, you know, bingo, other cases popped up, Maria Bruno in El Monte, Ashley Ellerin in the Hollywood Hills. And then they traced his history and found out that he had been a friend of the brother of Trisha Picaccio in Illinois.
Right.
So they caught themselves a serial killer. And again, his name was Michael Gargiulo, and his L.A. trial was spotlighted because Ashton Kutcher came to testify for the prosecution.
That's right.
And that was the day when the most reporters were there.
Absolutely. You talk about another story, King Creep, featuring a Michael King. Tell us about King Creep.
Wow. This is one of the most disturbing stories in the book. And I picked the 13 stories because of their disturbing nature.
Yes.
The book was originally going to be called I Will Show You Monsters. But I didn't like it because the I in the title is me. And my son is living in L.A. And he was taking some experimental nighttime photography.
Right.
And he took a picture of a rose garden at night, which ended up being the cover of the book. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, that's it. Because you could feel the gloominess coming off the photo in a way that I thought was unusual. So we call it dark roses. And the stories themselves are the dark roses, which grow out of blood-soaked soil. King Creep. This is about the murder of Denise Amber Lee in Northport, Florida. It was a home invasion. She was the young mother of two boys. She was taken to the killer's sex den, raped repeatedly, and then driven to a secluded spot and shot to death. Now, the case had a particularly sad angle in that Denise, who was the daughter of a cop and really smart, managed to get a hold of her abductor's cell phone. She called 911 and gave a real-time account of her predicament.
Incredible.
And at the same time, fellow motorists who saw Denise in the car in obvious distress called 911 and told the location of the car in real time to the 911 operator. But as fate would have it, the 911 operator's shift was almost over.
Mm-hmm.
She failed to absorb the import of what she was hearing, apparently, and Denise went unsaved.
Yeah.
Between the time that Denise was abducted and when she was killed, police received 6 911 calls. But by the time Michael King's car was stopped, he was alone, and there was blood splatter on the car. Michael King, King Creep, as I call him, grew up in Michigan. He's not a terribly bright fellow. He had for years managed to make a living as a handyman and a plumber. And for the past couple of years, things had been on the downturn for him. In 2008, when this happened, his life was a mess. He was 37 years old, divorced with custody of a son he could no longer afford, dating a series of unusually small blonde women, some of them riddled with dysfunction, but all of them looked younger than they were. And it was getting harder and harder for him to find real work. He was facing foreclosure on his Northport home. He had already had his apartment emptied of furniture by one of his exes. So he was angry with the women he dated, all of whom were diminutive blondes. He was a pervert, and he didn't go out of his way to hide it. He liked pretending his girlfriends were really young. And he did not have a criminal history, but when the monster within him came out, it came out big time. His financial worries and his girlfriend troubles combined into an intense anger with a strong sexual component. And in frustration, he decided he was going to steal a woman and take what he wanted. But as it turned out, he stole the wrong woman by Denise calling 911 on the killer's phone. There's no better evidence, is there?
No. Now, you have a story called A Dark Stretch of Road with someone called Mike. Is it Mike Tyson or Tyson?
It's Gary Tyson.
Gary. Oh, pardon me. Sorry. Anyway, dark.
Mike Tyson has enough troubles.
Yeah, I was going to say, sure. Yes, A Dark Stretch of Road. And this is certainly even more horrifying than some of the better known stories.
Yeah, this is terrible. Gary Tyson, his violent escape from prison and his subsequent run from the law not only turned out to be his ruin, but the ruin of his entire family. He and his Dorothy had three sons, Donald, Ricky, and Raymond. Gary was better at stealing than at working. In March 1961, he went on a two-week crime spree, hell-bent on making some quick cash. And in the end, he was arrested trying to steal weapons from a local National Guard armory. He had planned on smuggling the guns into Mexico to sell, but he was convicted and given a 25-year sentence. Dorothy remained completely under his spell and continued to see Gary as a wonderful husband and dedicated father who was a victim of an injustice, and he'd been framed, and
sure,
he was actually a nice man.
Yeah.
She told friends and family what a great dad Gary was. Sure. He called home every day to check on their progress and to guide their lives with his wisdom. And the three boys were inseparable growing up. They were not only close in age, but they felt like they were outsiders in their community due to the fact that dad was away. Now, in July 1966, happens to be the same month that Richard Speck did his thing, Gary was released early, serving only 5 of the 25 years he'd been sentenced to. But he didn't stay out for long. He went back in for passing a bad check. And while he was being taken from the court to the prison, he shot and killed correctional officer Jim Steiner,
mm-hmm.
a crime for which he was sentenced to life in prison. Now, Dorothy constantly reminded her children that their father was actually a victim. He only shot that security guard for self-defense. And the boys grew up thinking that their dad was wonderful. And when he asked them to help him escape from prison, they agreed to do it. And that happened in 1978. Now, also escaping with Gary into the U.S. Southwest,
mm-hmm.
and was a another hardcore criminal named Randy Greenewalt. And Greenewalt, Gary Tyson, and the three brothers went on the lam together. And the idea was to frequently switch vehicles, stay ahead of the man. But twice when they switched vehicles, Gary and Greenewalt, to the horror of Tyson's sons, killed the owners of the car and their families, which included a baby and his mother, both shot through the head by Gary Tyson.
Yeah, incredible.
So at this point, the boys know that this lifelong delusion they've been living under, that dad's a good guy, has been shattered, but they're stuck with him. Mm-hmm. And he arranges it so that he or Greenewalt is with one of the boys at all. They're never allowed the three of them to be together. And eventually a roadblock does them in. The oldest son is shot to death. Gary runs off into the desert and dies of exposure. Every man for himself are his last words. Must have felt great to it, the boys who adored him.
Yeah.
And his two sons went to prison for life for crimes that they never would have committed in a million years if they hadn't loved their dad.
Yeah. You follow this up with another heartwarming family you call Family of Terror. And the Sherman, yes, McCrary and the unholy alliance that forms. Please tell us about Family of Terror.
Okay. Well, Sherman McCrary and his partner in crime, his son-in-law, Carl Taylor, they had a specialty. And during the 1970s, while their families passed bad checks and made money, they would go out late at night and hold up donut shops, roadside donut shops, preferably those with a cute waitress working alone. They would take the money and the waitress, after which she would be raped by both men and killed in a deserted place. Now, after each murder, the family would up and move to another area and the process would begin again. And police never made a connection between the murders of the donut girls and the bad checks being passed. It took a while before they realized that those two things went together and this was a family doing these crimes. But once they got in the habit, McCrary and Taylor were killing two or three women per month.
Wow.
The murder that undid them was the murder of 20-year-old Leora Rose Looney on August 20th, 1971. The men sat in a diner, drank coffee, and waited for the other customers to leave. And as soon as they were alone with the girl behind the counter, Leora, they did their thing. They took the money from the cash register. They stole Leora. They took her out into the wilderness to be raped and then killed. And one witness the next day returns to the scene and tells the police the coffee cup on the counter, that one right there, that was the one that was being used by those creepy guys. So they dust the cup for fingerprints and perfect fingerprints show up. So the killers eventually decide that they're going to go straight. But it turns out that Sherman and Carl can only get along when they're doing crimes. The second that they try to do anything in the legitimate world, they hate each other's guts. So Carl goes out to rob a supermarket by himself, and it's a disaster. He doesn't get nearly all the money. He ends up shooting and wounding a cop in the parking lot, making his getaway. And witnesses get his license plate. And by the end of the evening, a full SWAT team is at the McCrary family home. Carl and his wife Ginger are arrested in Texas soon thereafter, on June 24th, 1972, and the fingerprint from the coffee cup matches Carl's prints. So Carl and Sherman ended up confessing to 7 murders, although the belief is that there were many more, and Sherman ended up committing suicide in prison.
Interesting. Another story that involves a family, but in different circumstances, is the murder of Craig Rideout. Tell us a little bit about this murder of Craig Rideout.
Well, you know, I love to write about crimes in the New York, in the Rochester, New York area.
Right.
So it was my hometown when I grew up. And this one was a biggie. It dominated the headlines for months. Starts about 11 p.m. Tuesday evening, July 19th, 2016. 50-year-old Craig Rideout of Penfield, New York, one of the nicer suburbs of Rochester, was last seen in his townhouse on New Wickham Drive. And he apparently vanished. He was an information technology specialist making good money. And also missing was his car. And he's reported missing by his sister on Wednesday morning. And at 5:30 Wednesday morning, a Mennonite farmer named Lowell Weaver is on his bicycle in the town of Jerusalem, New York, near Penn Yan. And he's on his way to do his farm chores. And up ahead, as he pedaled along the shoulder of the road, Weaver sees two vehicles parked alongside Adams Road. As he nears the vehicles, he saw two figures having a discussion, each standing between the cars. He sped up and heard their voices, but he couldn't understand any words. Later that morning, he's coming back on his breakfast break. Yeah, farmers have breakfast breaks. Yeah. The cars aren't there anymore, but he sees a shovel lying by the side of the road and some crumpled down weeds. So he follows the smashed down weeds into the woods, and he sees a tarpaulin. He lifts the tarpaulin, and what he sees sends a chill running up and down his spine. It's a bare human foot. So Weaver dropped the tarp, ran, got on his bike, and called the police. Police find a small hole had been dug nearby, and it looked as if someone had intended to bury a body, but found it too hard and gave up and covered the body with the tarp instead. The deputies removed the tarp to completely expose the body, and they winced at the face because the killers had used a corrosive drain cleaner to eat away the victim's face.
Wow.
Hopefully posthumously.
Yeah.
And most likely to delay identification.
Mm-hmm.
A Garrett had been used to choke the life out of the man, and the medical examiner later confirmed that the cause of death was asphyxiation. Now, the deputies at the scene are stunned because this effort has been made to slow the identification of the victim. And while they're looking at it, a phone goes off, and the phone is in the shorts pocket of the victim.
Wow.
So, how stupid could the killer be? They're not dealing with murder ink here, obviously. They answer the phone, and it's Craig's sister saying, "We're looking for Craig. We're worried we can't find him." And the cops say, we think we may know where he is. So, and while they're wondering who would be stupid enough to remove the guy's face but leave the phone in his pocket, authorities had no trouble tracing this back to Craig's family, another lovely family.
Yeah.
His estranged wife, Laura, is trying to get a divorce. There's a nasty custody battle going on for the youngest children, and she wants to run away with her new boyfriend. And they pull out of a pond in Mendon Ponds in the Rochester area a black bag that contains work gloves, disinfectant, and six empty bottles of drain cleaner, all of which can be traced to Laura's sons. And there's a trial. And the trial makes the front pages every day in Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
And the two sons, the wife, and the wife's boyfriend are all tried together. And as it turns out, all of the evidence incriminating the boyfriend are acquisition of the materials used in the crime.
Right.
Like, he was there when Laura bought the Drano and the bungee cords,
right,
and the tarp. But there was no evidence whatsoever that he knew what that stuff was for.
Right.
So the wife and the two sons are convicted, and the boyfriend was absolutely acquitted. And we don't even use his name in the book because he's freed. He's an innocent man and free to go about his life without any taint.
Wow, it's incredible. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop,
sure,
to hear about our sponsor, which is Talkspace. It's January 2022, and we all struggle to try to stick to our New Year's resolutions. This year, make your mental health part of your daily routine with Talkspace. Talkspace matches you with a licensed therapist, connecting by phone or computer to be able to help you whenever you need it. New Year's resolutions are a great idea, but therapy can give you the confidence to keep positive and progressing with your mental health throughout the year. Talking to a therapist has helped me immensely in the past, and everyone, especially these days, can benefit talking to a qualified, licensed therapist in a private and convenient place. Talkspace has thousands of licensed therapists across dozens of specialties ready to speak to you. Talkspace works to your schedule with live chat, video, and audio sessions. You get access to a private virtual room with just your therapist and you, with privacy and security being Talkspace's priorities. Whether it's depression, anxiety, self-doubt, or anything else you struggle with, Talkspace matches you with the right licensed therapist to help you get the support you need. Make your mental health more than another New Year's resolution with Talkspace. Visit Talkspace.com and get $100 off your first month when you use promo code TRUEMURDER at signup. That's $100 off at Talkspace.com, promo code TRUEMURDER. Now, Michael, we were talking about another story that you have included in this incredible 13 horrific true stories. Tell us a little bit about this savage waitress, Rachel Wing.
Oh, boy. You know, I covered this story a few years back, and it still kind of gets to me because it involves the young people of Pinellas Park, Florida, just had a lot of problems 13, 14 years ago. And it demonstrates that adolescent behavior can be turned into a pressure cooker by social media.
Mm-hmm.
It's a story of Rachel Wade, who's the savage waitress, who kills Sarah Ludeman, a high school senior, over Josh Camacho, who's a ne'er-do-well young man who likes to have a lot of girlfriends.
Sure.
Yeah. And Sarah and Rachel were trading insults online. And the story is old enough, so this is MySpace. It's pre-Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
But in a previous generation, ours, for example, two girls who were having a war of words with each other would have cooling off periods because they would physically separate. You would have to call on the phone in order to talk to the other, and who knows if they'd answer. But with social media, there's no way for the pressure to release, and things amp up quickly. And the other factor is that because the messages were put on social networks, they were in essence insulting one another in public.
Right.
So anger is increased, you know, tenfold by humiliation, embarrassment, and the case continues to build until there was a fight in the middle of the street. It was supposed to be a fist fight, but Rachel pulls out a kitchen knife and stabs Sarah to death with it. There are four eyewitnesses to the stabbing, two on either side, and their stories, of course, are very different. Rachel's friends spoke of a small woman, Rachel's tiny, defending herself against three larger women who had all jumped out of a van together and came at her all at once. Sarah's friends spoke of Rachel charging at Sarah and immediately plunging the kitchen knife into Sarah's chest. And until it all fell apart, Josh Camacho had his ducks in a row. In terms of scheduling, his girlfriends were perfectly complimentary to each other. Sarah was a high school girl with a curfew. She had to be home early. Rachel was a restaurant waitress who wasn't available until late. Camacho was a consummate playa, considered both Rachel and Sarah as friends with benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And most people understand that phrase to mean a non-romantic sexual relationship with no pretensions of monogamy. But nobody told that to Rachel and Sarah. Now, in terms of their personalities, sexual and otherwise, the women were also complimentary. Rachel was a cute, you know, she worked at Applebee's. She had a wild lifestyle. She was a sexual experimenter. And she was, unfortunately, as intense out of the sack as she was in. Whereas the much larger Sarah, you know, she'd been a heavy girl when she was young. And she was kind of a late bloomer. And she was new to the world of sex and needed to be taught. So she switched schools to be closer to Josh Camacho. And she adored him completely for reasons that befuddle adults everywhere.
Yeah.
Now, a large contributor to this entire tragedy was opiate addiction.
Right.
A frightening number of the city's young people were addicted to an opiate painkiller they called Roxy's.
Mm-hmm.
And the brand name was Roxycodone. Apparently the same as oxycodone. They're blue pills, and the kids called them blues. There had been a major theft at a pharmaceutical warehouse, and hundreds of thousands of pills were swiped. One crime that caused a tragic wave of serious drug addiction throughout Florida. And kids taking the pills were completely unaware that they were becoming addicted to the same active substance that was in heroin. They made them feel good, but pretty soon they needed more pills. So girls got hooked, and soon enough, they owed a debt to their male suppliers.
Sure.
Now there's a tendency for young people to feel immortal. They don't feel anxiety about danger the same way adults do. They're careless, they're reckless. And that natural tendency was exacerbated by the Roxy's, which further removed inhibitions and created a pain-free illusion of euphoria. Too many of Pinellas Park's teenage girls were skipping school, hanging out with their older boyfriends, taking drugs, having sex, and making babies. Now, why was Rachel the way she was? Well, her home appeared normal, devastated by what had occurred, but completely confused as to the reason. One thing, though, the Wades had a reluctance to discuss Rachel's older brother, who was estranged from the family. Rachel seldom mentioned her brother other than to say she hated him. Now, according to New Jersey psychological counselor Kathy Morelli, there is a change in brain chemistry that happens to people when they have sex, a biological attachment forms, and brain changes that shared experience produced, they cause potent emotions, causing normally mild people to resort to violence. And there was nothing normally mild about Rachel. Now, teenagers aren't adults, obviously. So it's a strong yet immature attachment that they have with their sex partners. Passion stirs up primal possessiveness. And psychologists agree that there's a strong chance that Rachel had problems at home. Most teen girls don't drop out of school and run away from home repeatedly because of an unwanted curfew. As for the cyberbullying, the mental health specialists I spoke to agreed that parents should have a monitor on their child's smartphones and computers, and they should check in silently to see what was being said in their child's world.
Sure.
They need to know that even though it's a virtual world, it's a real place with real feelings being created, not imaginary cyber threats. These things can turn into, you know, real violence. You know, Sarah's friend served as the virtual bully, egging her and Rachel on. And in teenage naivete, the Sarah camp thought it wasn't real and no violence would occur. But boy, did it ever. There was a moment during the trial that was just amazing because Rachel was put on the stand in her own defense.
Wow. Yeah.
And when she was doing her direct testimony, everything went swell because her lawyer led her through her testimony almost word by word.
Yeah.
You know, she was in fear. She was attacked by three girls at once. She felt a weapon was necessary. Well, cross-examination was a different story. And the prosecutor just lit into her and pretty soon had her in tears and babbling, saying things like, "I didn't mean to murder her." Yes, I threatened to kill her and then I carried out my threat. So anyway, she's in prison for a long time. And from her latest Department of Corrections mugshot, you know, the twinkle of youthful cuteness she used to have is now gone. She's just a con.
Yeah. You talk about another interesting family dynamic with the telltale knot. Tell us about identical twins and the mayhem that ensues.
Right. Well, I've known for a while that killers who are into bondage often have a specific preference when it comes to the knots they use.
Yeah.
You know, men with a bondage fetish, they're particular. Their rope work becomes like a signature.
Right.
And many fetishes for men are symptoms of being afraid of women. Whether this is another case where the victim is a very tiny blonde woman. Now, whether it be bondage or in which a master ties up a slave and renders her helpless, or pedophilia in which men desire small girls or small women who look like small girls, the resulting sensation of power and complete control is a perk. But the bottom line is that these things make the man aroused yet unafraid. Now, the thing with the knots being a signature was true in the BTK case. Dennis Rader in Wichita, Kansas, called himself Bind, Torture, and Kill. And it was true in the case of Richard Cottingham, whose story was told in a recent Netflix show, Times Square. I don't know if you've seen it.
It's
really good.
Yes, it is.
And it's true in this case as well. Our story takes place in Edgewater, Colorado. It's a sleepy suburb on Sloan Lake, just west of Denver. Population about 5,000, and the place resembled a picture postcard. 300 days of sunshine a year, everyone knew everyone, and nobody locked their doors. But on the afternoon of September 4th, 2003, that sense of security was shattered. A highway worker was picking up debris in a front loader alongside Highway 6 in Clear Creek Canyon when he made a puzzling discovery. It was a plastic bag with something sticking out of it, and when he hopped down to take a closer look, he saw it was a decomposing woman's leg. The man immediately called 911. Police arrived and determined that the woman had died in a bizarre and sadistic way, something out of a horror movie. She was tied up tightly with rope, and her face was masked with duct tape. Now, the body was identified as that of Heather DeWild, a young wife and mother who'd been reported missing 6 weeks earlier. The story had been big news. Her face had been on TV and the front page of the papers. Now, her husband was a piece of work. He was one half of twins, identical twins. He was Daniel. His brother was David. They were both porn addicts. Daniel, in particular, enjoyed looking at S&M porn, which featured women being hurt and bound. He'd gone as far as to try to make money by making his own S&M video with his wife as the victim. And that turned out to be his undoing, because it looked like the twins were going to get away with the murder until investigators took a close look at the porn movie that Daniel DeWild had made.
That's right.
And the knots in the movie were exactly the same as the knots on the woman's body. Busted.
Yeah. That's another example of people. I've seen quite a few examples more and more often of people getting justice via from the grave, basically through their efforts or from the grave anyway, getting their justice from beyond.
If a victim can't do anything else, scratch the guy's face.
Yeah, absolutely. Incredible. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages.
Sure.
Now, let's talk about a few thoughts on the Black Dahlia, because you felt it important to talk about that. And of course, we'd like to hear about that.
Well, I'm sure that 90% of your listeners know about the Black Dahlia.
Yes.
And you gave a little synopsis at the beginning of the show. But I treated it not as a crime, but as a true crime phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Because, well, with the exception of political assassinations and the deaths of celebrities, I can think of no single crime that has been written about more than the Black Dahlia. The murder of Elizabeth Short, 1947, changed the tone of L.A. L.A. went from being a overgrown little town where people felt safe to just a horrible, a place where this horrible thing happened. And again, the victim was a woman who came to L.A. to find fame and fortune and instead found brutal death. And she'd been bound and tortured for days before her death. Now, I've read, I think, every one of the books written about the Black Dahlia.
Right.
And I was never, ever happy. Two unrelated authors both claimed that their dad was the killer.
Yes.
One of them had a better case than the other, mm-hmm. but neither one of them had that great of a case. And then I read Black Dahlia, Red Rose by Pewee Twelve.
Right.
And I don't know if you've had her on your show.
No.
No. Mrs. Eatwell, who she lives in Paris. I had a chat with her. She was watching St. Peter's burn out her window.
Incredible.
Yes. We saw it on TV. Thought it was horrible. She was looking out her window at it. So I said, well, that was me on 9/11. I got to see that out my window. But anyway, lovely lady. But she wrote a book that didn't seem to rely on any of her relatives, didn't rely on any L.A. celebrities to sell books. She went to the L.A. police files, and she dug out the truth. And I don't understand why her book isn't more famous. I was tempted to write a book about the Black Dahlia until her book came out. Mm-hmm. Now I don't have to. She did the work. She found two promising suspects who were, for no apparent reason, allowed to skate. And upon closer examination, the pair, a narcissistic pimp and a well-connected restaurateur, they looked guilty. But the police dropped the ball, seemingly on purpose. She even found the crime scene, which was, as expected, a bloody mess. And she found a motel that days after Elizabeth Short disappeared, witnesses were saying one room was completely drenched with blood and fecal matter, but they didn't call police because they were a sleazy motel and they discouraged the police from coming. So, I mean, it's unbelievable that you can find that much blood in a hotel room and not call police. But the police in LA were different. They were corrupt through and through. You couldn't trust that they would go after the bad guys because the bad guys were often connected.
Yeah.
So, I mean, all of the books on the Black Dahlia mention this, that LAPD was so interwoven with corruption that the killer, even if he was known to the police, could avoid investigation if he were a person with the right connections. And that's the case here, which is scary.
Yes.
And yeah, I mean, the LAPD is not like that anymore. And when it did get better, it did some real damage control, mostly through the efforts of Jack Webb and his show Dragnet and Madam 12. And the LAPD is now a sophisticated and fair-minded force. But in 1947, not so much. And I've written about it from the other side, too. I've written books in which L.A. gangsters, you know, include top cops in their numbers.
Yeah.
So I suspect that we now know, and I recommend that right after you read Dark Roses, read Huey Twell's Black Dahlia, Red Rose. I think that's the story there.
Absolutely. You include a story about Sheila LaBar, Vengeance is Mine. And what I found particularly interesting is that many people have heard the stories of course, her murderous ways, but I wasn't so familiar with her disturbing family background and early life. Tell us a little bit about A Vengeance is Mine and Sheila LaBar.
Sure. Yeah, Sheila, I suspect this is true. Sheila was sexually abused as a child by her father and his friends. That those stories are corroborated by her sister, who, you know, didn't grow up to be a psycho killer.
Mm-hmm.
But Sheila definitely, if she lacked a solid conscience to begin with, she was abused into being a woman who was constantly angry and hateful. Now, as a young woman, she had a near-death experience when a boyfriend had the nerve to break up with her right to her face. So she was going to show him. So she swallowed a bottle of pills, got behind the wheel of her car, and drove until she passed out and crashed. And she almost killed herself in this way. She really did spend a long time in a coma. And when she woke up, she said that she had gone to heaven and God and a bunch of other men with beards told her that they weren't ready for her yet, that she still had a mission back on Earth. And they sent her back to complete her life. And her mission was to rid the world of pedophiles.
Sure.
Just like the ones who had abused her when she was a little girl.
Yes.
So after her husband dies unexpectedly, she recruited mentally handicapped men to work on her horse farm in New Hampshire. She then had sex with them. She dominated them. And she made them, under duress, to say the least, confess to pedophilia and to incest. At which point she said, aha, now God has given me permission to kill you. And she killed them, chopped them up, and burned their bodies in a big fire pit in her front lawn. So, I mean, this is the rarest of all serial killers. Mm-hmm. Women serial killers are rare to begin with. And often they kill in passive ways.
Yeah.
They poison their boyfriends. But here's a woman killer who's beaten the crap out of her victims until they're dead, and then chopping them up. And she was like like the witch in Hansel and Gretel.
Yeah.
Only she didn't care about little girls. She just wanted little boys in her oven. And Dark Roses concentrates on Sheila's bizarre behavior, because if you can figure out what was going on in that tortured brain of hers, let me know.
Yeah.
Because I've looked at it all directions, and it defies absolute interpretation. Now, in normal conditions, it's hard to determine when a person with mental problems is malingering.
Right.
Since the malingering itself can be a symptom of the illness. So I provided as much as I could about what Sheila did and what she said about what she did. But what was actually going on in her? I mean, did she really believe she went to heaven? Did she really believe that she was justified to do these things? Or was she just angry at men because they'd abused her when she was little? You can't tell. Now, when I went to Epping, New Hampshire to cover the story, I was busted by the local police. The two Epping, New Hampshire cops took me into their station and handcuffed me to a bench. Now, they let Sheila go for months, even though they knew something was seriously bad was going on at the ranch. But they had no trouble busting the writer who came up to investigate. Now, and the difference is that she was one of the richest women in town. And that's another story. She conned her way into riches by taking the last name of a man she'd never married, a man that she'd only cohabitated with for a brief period of time. And when they asked her for her marriage license, she said, "I don't have a license. I have a pistol and I'll use it." So they wrote down she was his wife, and she'd had her husband's will rewritten.
Incredible.
Clearly written by her. You know, the will was a testament to wonderful, wonderful person that Sheila. And she got the farm, and she's one of the richest women in town. And if she gets herself alone with a cop, she exposes herself and yells rape. So here's the two cops, the two Epping cops are at Sheila's house. Sheila's latest boyfriend is missing. The boyfriend's mother wants to know what's going on. And instead of having, and then Ellen, they find a human bone, something that looks like a human bone, in her fire pit. And instead of one cop going to get the search warrant and the other one staying with Sheila, they leave her alone in the middle of nowhere.
They
go get the search warrant together. By the time they come back, the bone's gone, the victim's sneakers are gone, and Sheila's covered with ashes. Anyway,
wow.
Luckily, Sheila tape recorded the torture sessions of her victims. She had on tape their confessions that they were pedophiles and they had committed incest, and claimed even after she was arrested that this was the reason they had to go. She'd been sleeping with pedophiles. They needed to be burned. And she quoted, you know, biblical passages that talk about purification by fire.
Wow.
Anyway, I managed to photograph the crime scene, and eventually the charges against me were dropped.
Oh, thank God.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was working, and but you know, I don't want to go back to Epping, New Hampshire anytime soon. So if they're worried about me coming, they don't have to.
There you go.
Sheila's in prison for life.
There you go. I'd like to discuss one more story with you. And
sure.
This is the very disturbing, because it involves children, this Breckenridge.
Yeah.
But because it's unfamiliar to me, I'm pretty sure that people haven't heard this incredible story. Tell us briefly about Breckenridge.
Sure. It was while I was in Epping, New Hampshire. It was the day before I went to Sheila's farm and ended up in handcuffs. I learned that it was June 25th, 2008. It was the 42nd anniversary of the double murders behind my house when I was 9.
Right.
So there's something about the summer solstice. Crimes get ickier around the first few days of summer. It's 2008, Randolph, Vermont area. And a man named Michael S. Jakes was what you might call a kiddie porn enthusiast.
Yeah.
And he belonged to a club he'd found on the so-called dark web called Breckenridge. Now, Breckenridge may have been his own invention, and the guys who were the other members were his friends and acquaintances, or it was just the tip of a Breckenridge iceberg that the rest of which we haven't seen because it knows how to stay submerged. Club members shared photos and videos and sometimes victims. Now, Jakes was an active member of the group. He'd already recruited and videotaped a number of young victims, giving his comrades the kind of entertainment they wanted. And at some point, he decided to up the ante. He had these girls convinced that they would be killed if they failed to serve their masters as ordered to do. Now, Breckenridge was an organization that recruited 9, 10, and 11-year-old girls and told them that they had to learn how to be adequate sexual partners for these men, or else bad things would happen to them. And they're basically terrorized into being these guys' little nymphet playmates. Now, we talk about a girl in the story named Janet, not her real name, but she was one of Jake's success stories. And she'd learned all the sex acts, and she was very close to getting the 75% approval rate she needed to graduate.
Wow.
And Jake's tells her that he really would rather talk about sex and pleasure, but there comes a time sometimes when girls won't do what they're told, and they are scheduled, this is quote, scheduled for termination. And sure enough, Janet finds out that her friend Brooke Bennett, 12 years old, is not behaving as she should and has been scheduled for termination. And Janet is forced to, Janet's told that if she finally does the right thing at the last moment, she might be able to save herself. But it's up to Janet to help get Brooke Bennett into Michael Jake's house. So they come over together under the lie that there's going to be a pool party. And Brooke shows up with her bathing suit and Janet leaves. And Brooke Bennett goes missing. Her body's found and cops know who's responsible right away because Jake's, Janet, and Brooke Bennett were all appeared on a surveillance tape at a convenience store earlier on the day of Brooke's murder. So they go after Janet. They start questioning Janet. Finally, she starts to say, well, you know, I belong to this club. It's called Breckenridge. We're supposed to have sex with men. And she says that Michael Jakes is one of the guys. So, and it turns out that Janet's stepfather is another member of Breckenridge, and he's in Texas throwing hard drives out the window when he finds out that Jakes has been arrested. And it did a horrible thing to that area of Vermont. The crime happened in the early summer, and at the end of the summer, all the way to Halloween, they were so traumatized. They were talking about canceling Halloween because of child molesters.
Right.
Hopefully they've recovered to some extent now. The case did bring about some legislative changes in the way pedophiles were treated in the court system, because Jakes had been arrested multiple times for the same stuff. And every time he'd been let out. One time he was let out early on purpose because they wanted to get into a program for pedophiles. And he couldn't do that when he was a prisoner. So they let him out. They let him out to do it again rather than keeping him in jail and away from little girls. So it's a guilt that that section of Vermont had a lot of trouble shaking.
Yes. I want to thank you so much, Michael Benson, for coming on and talking about your latest Dark Roses, 13 Horrific True Stories. I know this is a Benson book. For those that might want to take a look at other work, I know there's an Amazon page, but is there a website?
I still don't have a website. I'm sorry, Dan. But on Amazon, I am the Michael Benson with the white beard. I think author Michael Benson does the trick. And I'm on Facebook. And if you want to, by all means, I've had many friend requests over the years where the friend in common is Dan Zupansky.
Oh, shucks.
And that's another way to get in touch with me. And I do have many true crime books, and Dark Roses with the great cover photo by my son and cover design by my daughter. It's truly a Benson book.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Michael Benson.
Thanks, Dan. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Good night.
Have a good one. Bye-bye.